The labor movement in the 80s and 90s was considerably weakened by the decline of manufacturing, by the flight of factories to other countries, by the hostility of the Reagan administration and its appointees on the National Labor Relations Board. Yet organizing continued, especially among white-collar workers and low-income people of color. The AFL-CIO put on hundreds of new organizers to work among Latinos, African Americans, and Asian Americans. Rank-and-file workers in old, stagnant unions began to rebel. In 1991, the notoriously corrupt leadership of the powerful Teamsters Union was voted out of office by a reform slate. The new leadership immediately became a force in Washington and took the lead in working for independent political coalitions outside the two major parties. But the labor movement as a whole, much diminished, was struggling for survival. Against the overwhelming power of corporate wealth and governmental authority, the spirit of resistance was kept alive in the early 90s, often by small-scale acts of courage and defiance. On the West Coast, a young activist named Keith McHenry and hundreds of others were arrested again and again for distributing free food to poor people without a license. They were part of a program called Food Not Bombs. More Food Not Bombs groups sprang up in communities around the country. In 1992, a New York group interested in revising traditional ideas about American history received approval from the New York City Council to put up 30 metal plaques high on lampposts around the city. One of them, placed opposite the Morgan corporate headquarters, identified the famous banker J.P. Morgan as a Civil War draft dodger. In fact, Morgan had avoided the draft and profited in business deals with the government during the war. Another plaque, placed near the stock exchange, portrayed a suicide and carried the label, "Advantage of an Unregulated Free Market." The general disillusionment with government during the Vietnam years and the Watergate scandals, the exposure of anti-democratic actions by the FBI and the CIA, led to resignations from government and open criticism by former employees. A number of former CIA officials left the agency and wrote books critical of its activities. John Stockwell, who had headed the CIA operation in Angola, resigned, wrote a book exposing the CIA activities, and lectured all over the country about his experiences. David McMichael, a historian and former CIA specialist, testified at trials on behalf of people who had protested government policy in Central America. FBI agent Jack Ryan, a 21-year veteran of the Bureau, was fired when he refused to investigate peace groups. He was deprived of his pension and for some time had to live in a shelter for homeless people. Sometimes the war in Vietnam, which had ended in 1975, came back to public attention in the 80s and 90s through people who had been involved in the conflicts of that day. Some of them had since made dramatic turnabouts in their thinking. John Wall, who prosecuted Dr. Benjamin Spock and four others in Boston for conspiring to obstruct the draft, showed up at a dinner honoring the defendants in 1994, saying the trial had changed his ideas. Even more striking was the statement by Charles Hutto, a U.S. soldier who had participated in the atrocity known as the My Lai Massacre, in which a company of American soldiers shot to death women and children by the hundreds in a tiny Vietnamese village. Interviewed in the 80s, Hutto told a reporter, "I was 19 years old, and I'd always been told to do what the grown-ups told me to do. But now I'll tell my sons, if the government calls, to go, to serve their country, but to use their own judgment at times, to forget about authority, to use their own conscience. I wish somebody had told me that before I went to Vietnam. I didn't know. Now I don't think there should be even a thing called war, because it messes up a person's mind." It was this legacy of the Vietnam War, the feeling among a great majority of Americans that it was a terrible tragedy, a war that should not have been fought, that plagued the Reagan and Bush administrations, which still hoped to extend American power around the world. In 1985, when George Bush was vice president, former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger had warned the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Vietnam brought a sea change in domestic attitudes, a breakdown in the political consensus behind foreign policy. When Bush became president, he was determined to overcome what came to be called the Vietnam Syndrome, the resistance of the American people to a war desired by the establishment. And so he launched the air war against Iraq in mid-January 1991 with overwhelming force so the war could be over quickly, before there was time for a national anti-war movement to develop. The signs of a possible movement were there in the months of the pre-war buildup. On Halloween, 600 students marched through downtown Missoula, Montana, shouting, "Hell no, we won't go." In Shreveport, Louisiana, despite the Shreveport Journal's front-page headline, "Poll Favors Military Action," the story was that 42% of the respondents thought the USAID should initiate force, and 41% said, "Wait and see." The November 11, 1990 Veterans Parade in Boston was joined by a group called Veterans for Peace, carrying signs, "No more Vietnams, bring 'em home now," and "Oil and blood do not mix, wage peace." The Boston Globe reported that the protesters were greeted with respectful applause and at some places strong demonstrations of support by onlookers. One of those onlookers, a woman named Mary Belay Dressier, said, "Personally, parades that honor the military are somewhat troublesome to me because the military is about war, and war is troublesome to me." Most Vietnam veterans were supporting military action, but there was a strong dissident minority. In one survey that showed 53% of the veterans polled saying they would gladly serve in the Gulf War, 37% said they would not. Perhaps the most famous Vietnam veteran, Ron Kovic, author of Born on the 4th of July, made a 30-second television speech as Bush moved toward war. In the appeal, broadcast on 200 television stations in 120 cities across the country, he asked all citizens to stand up and speak out against war. "How many more Americans coming home in wheelchairs like me will it take before we learn?" That November of 1990, several months into the Kuwait crisis, college students in St. Paul, Minnesota demonstrated against war, the local press reported. It was a full-blown anti-war demonstration with mothers pushing kids in strollers, college professors and grade school teachers carrying signs, peace activists bedecked in peace symbols, and hundreds of students from a dozen schools singing, beating drums, and chanting, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, we won't fight for Amoco." 10 days before the bombing began at a town meeting in Boulder, Colorado, with 800 people present, the question was put, "Do you support Bush's policy for war?" Only 4 people raised their hands. A few days before the war began, 4,000 people in Santa Fe, New Mexico, blocked a 4-lane highway for an hour, asking that there be no war. Residents said this was larger than any demonstration in the Vietnam era. On the eve of the war, 6,000 people marched through Ann Arbor, Michigan, to ask for peace. On the night the war began, 5,000 people gathered in San Francisco to denounce the war and formed a human chain around the federal building. Police broke the chain by swinging their clubs at the hands of the protesters. But the San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed a resolution declaring the city and county a sanctuary for those who, for moral, ethical, or religious reasons, cannot participate in war. The night before Bush gave the order to launch the bombing, a 7-year-old girl in Lexington, Massachusetts, told her mother she wanted to write a letter to the president. Her mother suggested it was late and she should write the next day. "No, tonight," the girl said. She was still learning to write, so she dictated a letter. "Dear President Bush, I don't like the way you are behaving. If you would make up your mind there won't be a war, we won't have to have peace vigils. If you were in a war, you wouldn't want to get hurt. What I'm saying is, I don't want any fighting to happen. Sincerely yours, Serena Cabot."